But for now, we're still in Galatians. As Paul somehow or another, at some time or another, was writing back to this church, these churches of Galatia, while he was on his missionary journey. So as we turn there, I want us to think about something to get our minds ready for what Paul has for us today, to get us thinking along the lines of what Paul has been doing. For I know some of us have been like Paul. We get it. Justification by faith. We get it. Mike, Jared, how many different ways can you come at this various doctrine? Well, I'm assuming every person in here, if we were to think back on those who have been most effective at getting information across to us, had some things in common as those people would come to mind, whether they were a teacher from the past, a coach, a mentor in the workplace or your career, or some leader or of an organization. I would venture to guess that those who were very good at communicating information had some things in common. First, I would imagine that they were knowledgeable. They had to have knowledge regarding the subject that they were communicating, or otherwise they would have no credibility. They would be of no use if they didn't know what they were talking about, correct? But secondly, they couldn't just know what they were talking about. I would imagine those who were most effective, that it was apparent that they also cared deeply about what they were talking about. They were passionate about it. It wasn't just information. It was coming out of a life where they were living by those principles or that information as well. But lastly and thirdly, I would guess that they not only cared that the information was communicated clearly, but that they cared that you got it as well, and that you understood it, and not only understood it, but were buying into it. Whatever the message was that they were passing on, whether technical information of a job or some sort of concept, of vision, or of an organization, whatever it was, they were probably good at those things. And perhaps so much did they care that they were not satisfied to just keep saying the same things the same way if they sensed that some on the team or in the organization weren't tracking and weren't getting it yet. But perhaps they were willing to come at it from different angles, take different approaches, get creative if they needed to, until every single person understood and was on board with the message. Well, it seems to me that this kind of thing is what we've been witnessing the last 2+ chapters, as the Apostle Paul has been trying to get across the big idea, his main point of this epistle, which is, do not depart from the gospel of salvation through grace by faith that I communicated to you at first. Do not depart from it in any way. Do not add to it. Do not take away from it. Do not alter it. For what you will have at the end of the day is a false gospel. For what we have seen Paul do is come at it from so many different angles. I mean, he reminded them, first of all, of his credentials in chapter 2, that his apostleship was first-rate apostleship, just like Peter and John and the others from Jerusalem. He pointed them back to their experience, how they had been impacted by his gospel, and how there's no other explanation for what happened in their lives other than the true God acting in their lives through that message. He then moved on to a technical explanation. Paul got very technical for a while, showing why his gospel was in line with the Old Testament in the life of Abraham and even the law of Moses. He then went on to show them the greatness of what they had, that they didn't have just intellectual knowledge, that they were sons of the living God and that the Spirit dwelt in them. And if they were to go away from that message, he showed the deficiencies of the alternative message, that it was weak and it was beggarly compared to his gospel. And then last week, Pastor Mike opened up for us the personal plea. Paul resorted to the personal aspect of this, that they had loved him and he had shown his love for them. And were they willing to throw all that away? And was he now their enemy because he was telling them the truth? He pleaded with them to not depart from that gospel. Well, today, as we move on in chapter 4, beginning in verse 21, I ask that you bear with Paul one more week, one more time for one more week. I ask that you bear up with me and with Paul, where he gives it one last effort to try to get the message across to his readers. But this time, he will now turn to an illustration to try to put it into a picture, of a word picture, so to speak, an illustration, to try to really now get home to every last person. If there's any stragglers who still don't get it, this is what you will be doing if you depart from my gospel. For Paul will use a familiar story. He will take a narrative from the Old Testament with two main characters, two mothers. And those two mothers will represent two kinds of covenants, one done by man's efforts, the other done relying on God's promise. And those two mothers will have two sons, which represent two kinds of offspring. And each of those offspring will have their own inheritance. One will be cast out, the other will receive the promise. And so without any further ado, let's get into this narrative, this story, in verses 21 through 23, where Paul sets up, he reminds us of the setting, the main thing he wants to go at from this Old Testament familiar story, where Paul asks the Galatians in verse 21, where he says, "Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by a slave woman and one by a free woman. But the son of the slave was born according to the flesh, while the son of the free woman was born through promise." So after Paul's passionate pastoral plea last week, where he was just begging them, do not depart from this, he now turns to the Old Testament again. But yet notice, it's very clear, isn't it, that Paul isn't turning here to a technical argument from the Old Testament as he did before with Abraham and the law of Moses. But now he's turning to the Old Testament in the form of a story. He's going from the technical use of the Old Testament to now an aerial perspective, trying to ask them and get them to see what is the whole flow, really, of the Old Testament. I mean, the law of Moses has a context. It didn't come out of nowhere. God didn't begin with the law of Moses. The whole Old Testament, or at least the first five books of the Bible, have an overall bigger aerial perspective. For I believe that's what Paul is doing here when he even asks this question. You who want to be under the law, referring to the law of Moses, of course, and all that it requires and all you must do, do you not listen to the law? Where there, I believe Paul is not using it in the narrow sense, law of Moses, but the whole first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, were referred to as the law. As Jesus himself would even refer to the law and the prophets and the writings. And so the law could be referring to the whole first five books. And Paul's saying, don't you listen to what the whole flow of all of what Moses wrote is saying? Because look what he goes into in verse 21. He doesn't go back to a technical part of the law. He goes to this narrative of Abraham. He launches, I should say, in verse 22, to the story of Abraham's two sons, who were the most important of his two, or of all of his sons. We know that he had more than two sons with a wife who he took on after Abraham, or after Sarah had died. But his two sons are the two most important, who represent two ways of coming to God and were the fathers of two particular nations. And he had those two sons, one by a slave woman who was Hagar, right? And one by a free woman who was Sarah. And I trust that you're familiar enough with the narrative of Genesis 16 through 21, which came after God makes a promise to Abraham in chapter 12 that he will have offspring and he will become a great nation and God will bless those that bless him and curse those that curse him and he will have land and eventually through him all the families of the earth will be blessed. And when you think about it, that took a great amount of faith, didn't it? Because even before Genesis 12, coming out of chapter 11, we see at the end of chapter 11 in Genesis that Sarai at that time, she was barren. And not only was she barren, but she was getting up there in years. She was probably in her mid-60s at the point in Genesis 12 when God came to Abraham. And so what we have is Abraham, he does believe, he obeys, he picks up his family and he moves. But time goes by in the land and no children yet. And Abraham starts to get a bit discouraged in chapter 15. But yet God is so gracious and he comes and he reaffirms the covenant in chapter 15. And That's when God goes through the animal that has been cut in two, that signifying that God will fulfill the covenant. And that's when it says Abraham believed God and his faith was credited for righteousness in Genesis 15:6. But it's in chapter 16. It's in chapter 16 where things take a detour, at least for a bit, but a major detour. Because it is in chapter 16 that is not Abraham, but it's Sarah initially, whose faith is starting to falter. And she decides that she's going to come up with a plan to help God's promise come along a little bit, or to actually have it happen at all. At this time, wondering, is God ever going to give us children? And so she comes up with a plan. And we read about this in Genesis 16, verses 1 through 4, where it says, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. And she had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abraham, 'Behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. So go into my servant, so it may be that I shall obtain children from her or by her.' And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. And so after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress." And one thing that certainly stands out here is a lesson about sin. I mean, how short-sighted. I mean, it's easy for us to say now, but when you're in that moment when you are being tempted and when you do take your eyes off God and his promises and his word and the fact that he will be faithful and you're looking at what sin is offering, it's amazing what can make sense. I mean, to think that this would work out and that God would bless this and that there wouldn't be any trouble in the family because of what would happen here. And boy, did they experience the consequences of this particular sin. I mean, she didn't even have to have the baby yet. And it was apparent she was pregnant and there was animosity between the two women. And then down through the years, all the trouble. And now here, 4,000 years later, we are still experiencing trouble and problems in this world, specifically the Middle East, because of this decision right here. Sin has consequences. It always does. And sometimes the stains of sin can be generational and go on and on. And here we are 4,000 years later, still reaping the effects of this choice here. Sin always has consequences, even if God forgives, and which he will, and still uses those who commit those sins. But boy, is it amazing how things can make sense when you're looking at the sin and what it has to offer. And we have to trust God and go back and get our eyes back on God and his word and his ways. Well, we know the problems that took place. Yet God does work through Abraham and Sarah because his promises were unconditional. They were unconditional. And God forgives them. And God, in essence, starts over with them in chapter 17, where he gives them new names, changes their names to Sarah and Abraham. Circumcision is given as a sign that the covenant is still on. And eventually Sarah does conceive and she has a son. To the point, or after the point of not just general barrenness, but at the ripe old age of 90, in past childbearing age. For Genesis 18 tells us that she was advanced in years and past childbearing age. So not just general barrenness, but past the time of having children normally. And Romans 4:19 tells us that Abraham, his body was as good as dead. Which I think we can take to mean not just he was close to death, but for both of these individuals, the biological functions of having children, the time had passed. The time had passed. And yet in verse 23, what's it say? As we move on in verse 23, the mode of these two women then, having these two sons, is contrasted. For Abraham had two sons, one by each of these women. And the mode of having these two is contrasted as in the flesh, which would be Ishmael, versus having a son of promise, which we know that would be Isaac. Not that biological processes were not involved in Sarah conceiving by Abraham. I think they were. Certainly a work of the Spirit, reviving those abilities and having children the natural way. But yet, it was not according to the flesh. in the sense that it was with Hagar, where, hey, let's come up with a way to help God's plan along, you see. They waited on God's promise and saw God's promise come to fulfillment. Even when they were past the natural ability, the promise was finally fulfilled. And so these words, flesh and promise, what they represent are the concepts that we have been looking at in Galatians, where flesh does equate to man's schemes, man's scheming to achieve and gain what only God can give, versus promise, where we acquire a promised outcome by trusting in God's ways. In other words, faith. I mean, those are the two things that are being contrasted in Galatians, that they're being offered a gospel of faith plus works of the flesh, and Paul saying, no, it's got to be faith alone, and you do not perfect yourself by works of the flesh. In terms of our relationship with God, it is faith and promise. That's where we get what we need from God in terms of our standing. So these two births, again, are meant to, they're meant to set in our minds the two different ways about going about obtaining what God has promised. And it's interesting, Paul, he could have stopped there, you know, and it would have been a rather powerful reminder, a very powerful illustration of the fact that we need to wait and trust in God at times. And even though it may not seem like it's going to happen, we need to know that God is faithful. He does not change. He will be true to his word, as we see in these two situations. But Paul decides not to stop there. He decides to go on and take it to another level and decide to use these two women then as an analogy for two kinds of covenants that we know from redemptive history. And that's in verses 24 through 27, where Paul goes on and decides to employ some symbolism regarding these two mothers. Look at verse 24. Now, this may be interpreted allegorically. These women are two covenants, if you stop and think about it. One is from Mount Sinai, bearing children for slavery. She is Hagar. And now Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and she corresponds to present Jerusalem. For she, Jerusalem, is in slavery with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother. Now, Paul is doing something, I would admit, quite surprising here. I would say even unwarranted in the typical situation as we read and apply God's word. For what Paul is doing is he is making an analogy or giving things symbolic reference that really aren't alluded to in the scripture itself. He's kind of like, what I would say is he's just on the fly taking these two situations and say, you know what, let's humor me for a bit while I use these two from this story, and let's see how they do and can represent the two kinds of covenants if we think about it. For again, we are not to allegorize the scriptures. We believe that the allegorical method, if that is how you, in your normal reading, look at the word of God, trying to find hidden spiritual meanings behind characters and people and places and things, that is not how we normally interpret the scriptures. Paul's not giving us license to do that here. But rather, for his own purposes in the moment, under inspiration of the Spirit, he is repurposing this story and will show how it represents two kinds of covenants, one done by man's works, the other done by faith. And so the comparison that Paul decides to make are two covenants. These women represent two covenants. In verse 24, one where man must hold up his end of the bargain to receive the promised blessing, which is Mount Sinai, and one where God freely provides all that is needed, and man acquires the promise by faith. Hagar corresponds to Mount Sinai, which is the Moses covenant, and the technical definition of the law of Moses, where the message is, do them and live. You must do all that is written in it if you want to receive the blessings, right? We can't pick and choose, and the standard is perfection. And that corresponds, obviously, to slavery, which is the status that Hagar was in even after she had the son. Their status didn't change, even though they were able to contrive and work up this solution and have a child, but yet she was still a slave, and so was the child. Which is kind of ironic, the correspond Sinai to slavery, because Abraham's descendants had just been delivered out of slavery. I mean, they had just come out of bondage in Egypt, and Here Paul's saying is, you know what? The people who came out, they still remained in slavery, at least spiritual slavery. Because what they had done is they had looked at the Moses covenant not for what it was intended to be, which was a constant reminder that we need to look to God in his promises and in his word. It pointed out one sin which should drive you to God by faith and forgiveness. But yet did turn it in to a works-based system, and also over the years took pride in the fact that not only were they Abraham's descendants, but they had the law of Moses. And so they wore it as a badge of honor, and they completely missed the fact that God was going to move on one day to a new covenant, and Messiah would come and free them from all the things they could not be freed from under that system. And so that corresponds to Mount Sinai, which would have been a shock to the Judaizers, which would have been, again, kind of a slam to their system that they were coming and saying, you gotta go from faith and back to the law of Moses to complete salvation. And Paul is quick to point out that that slavery didn't end in the wilderness wanderings. I mean, it's easy to look at that first generation of the children of Abraham who came out of slavery, they received the law, and then they turned to idolatry and they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, the Sinai wilderness. But Paul wants to point out, you know what? Even today, in our common day, his day, Jerusalem itself is still in that same slavery. So Hagar also corresponds to that modern day Jerusalem in verse 25, which again, think about possibly the Judaizers who were affecting the churches of Galatia. We know that from the book of Acts that there were men who came out from Jerusalem and would say, you need to follow the law of Moses to be saved. That's fine that you have faith, but you need to be circumcised. You need to have the law of Moses. Paul doesn't have the complete gospel. We're here from the headquarter church in Jerusalem to kind of fill in the gaps. And Paul says, you know what? Jerusalem today is still in slavery because they have rejected again and continue to reject God's purposes of salvation now through his son. They rejected Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, that was the whole point of Stephen's message, that not only at Sinai, but all through the history of their nation, they had over and over rejected God's purposes. And this was the last form of rejection. Those in modern-day Jerusalem with their religious system of works and man-made laws, but also works and all those things, they were in slavery. But there's another city that Paul mentions. There's another city, though. In verse 26, see Jerusalem above, the heavenly Jerusalem, which corresponds to an entirely different kind of covenant, represented not by Hagar, but Abraham's free wife, Sarah, who was in freedom. And so, Paul says, Jerusalem, that heavenly Jerusalem, is ultimately our mother. She is the one who has given birth to us. We are her offspring, and we will populate that city. And so Sarah corresponds to heavenly Jerusalem representing freedom. And so you see, according to all of this that Paul is saying, all of this, what he's saying is, it's not about who your father is. All parties would have claimed Abraham as their father. It's about who your mother is. Are we spiritual descendants of Hagar, trying in our own efforts and our own way to help God along, to achieve salvation or a standing with God? Or are we children of Sarah? Are we children of Sarah? And if you can show the next slide, which I've tried to put it in the pictures, I know this is kind of a lot here, but basically Paul here is saying there's two seed lines off of the person, the patriarch of Abraham. Where on the left, you have the way of the flesh, slavery, and banishment, which is represented by Hagar, who was a slave, and she gave birth to Ishmael through the flesh, in an effort of the flesh. But this is all an analogy, Paul says, or it can be used as an analogy, of that Sinai covenant of slavery at Mount Sinai in Arabia, which corresponds to present-day Jerusalem. It's still going on. And she gives offspring to children who are still according to the flesh, still in bondage, still in slavery. Whereas on the other side, you have the way of promise, of you have freedom and faith, which is represented by Sarah, who was free and gave birth to a son of promise, trusting in God's ways eventually, which represents a covenant of promise and freedom, perhaps the new covenant. Paul, interestingly enough, doesn't mention which covenant. Was it the Abraham covenant, perhaps, or the new covenant? which is represented by a new heavenly Jerusalem, which are populated by children who are born of the promised Spirit. As we'll see in a moment, he will say Isaac was born according to the Spirit or by the Spirit, and so are we. So are we. And you see, brothers and sisters, the way that we connect to the spiritual seed line of promise is by totally bypassing the Sinai covenant, totally bypassing Jerusalem and its system. We don't have to become Jews or connect to their genealogies and their ways. Rather, we connect to God directly, or at least on this other path, through promise and faith. Becoming heirs. And how powerful for Paul to see that those who were Jews and trying to send the Galatians back to the law, that they themselves were descendants of Ishmael. That those who were physically the descendants of Abraham, if they were trusting in works, were actually the descendants of Hagar. Whereas we, even though we may not be Jews, are descendants of Sarah and Isaac spiritually. And Paul had proof. He had proof of this from the Old Testament. He had encouragement of this from the Old Testament, that things like this can happen. For look at verse 27, where Paul says, "For it is written, rejoice, O barren one who does not bear, and break forth and cry aloud. For you who are not in labor, for the children of the desolate will one, or the children of the desolate one will be more than those of the one who has a husband." And so here what Paul does is he quotes Isaiah chapter 54, verse 1, which was a low point in Jewish history. Jerusalem had just been sacked and stripped of her inhabitants, and they had been carried off into Babylon. And at this point in Jewish history, it couldn't get any lower. And of course, it was all going to be based on the power of God in terms of all the things that he would accomplish through this nation. But now it had become as evident as ever that if something was going to happen through this nation, it would be by God's strength and God's doing. They were helpless. They couldn't do a thing. Jerusalem was now barren. And yet, what does God do? He eventually does, in his strength, in his power, by his grace, repopulate Jerusalem once again. They came out of captivity. Just like with Sarah, who eventually saw God work in giving her a promised son. So we can trust that there is a heavenly Jerusalem. There is a city whose maker and builder is God. He has done it before. He can do it again. We have to trust, like what Mike read from Revelation 21, that there is a city that we will populate and dwell one day in the new heaven, in the new earth. And it will be populated by those who are relying on God's doing, on God's doing. That's the lesson that Paul wants us to learn. And we, like the receivers of the prophet of Isaiah, we have to trust that even though it doesn't always look like it, even though it looks like all the odds are stacked against us, and it looks like, how can God be working in this situation? And everyone around me is against this message and this gospel. Well, Paul lays out the situation of the children, going back to Genesis, to encourage us of what the outcome was between those two sons. Look at verse 28 through 31. "Now you, brothers, like Isaac, are children of promise. But just as it was at the time he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, so also it is now. But what does the scripture say? What was the outcome? Cast out the slave woman and her son. For the son of the slave woman shall not inherit with the son of the free woman. So, brothers, we are not children of the slave, but of the free woman." So here, what we have for the first time, Paul uses Isaac's name specifically. And Paul explicitly ties our standing and our status and our birth to that like Isaac's, the result of promise, the result of God's doing, and a result of the Spirit, as we see here that Isaac was born of the Spirit. And so Paul has been telling us we are born of the Spirit by faith, receiving that promise. And so, as we'll see, just like Isaac, we too will not be cast out, but the spiritual descendants of Hagar will. And they might be saying to Paul, "Paul, that sounds good, but there's one problem, Paul. Going your way, choosing your gospel over this other gospel, it brings suffering. It brings persecution. And these other teachers have it pretty good. They don't suffer like you did, Paul. And this doesn't make sense. You're telling us we're the sons of God, we're the daughters of God, that the Spirit of God dwells within us. Why are we suffering?" Well, in verse 29, Paul alludes to Genesis 21, this account here, which was the celebration of Isaac after he had finally been weaned from nursing. And there was a big deal made about Isaac at that point, if you recall. In Genesis 21, it says, "And the child Isaac grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned." And what you had here was all the tension taken away from who? From Ishmael. A big deal now being made about Isaac, the son of promise, who was not technically the firstborn, but yet was the one of promise. From an earthly perspective, was not the one who a big deal should have been made of, but Isaac was the son of promise. And was everyone happy and celebratory about this child of promise, that he was here and we're having a party about this son? No. For what does it say in Genesis 21:9? Sarah noticed something. She saw that the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had born to Abraham, was laughing. And if you go back to Genesis 21 there, the marginal reading for laughing might say sporting with or playing with, but also can be taken to mean laugh and mockery. It can kind of be, is it positive or negative? Initially, it might not be clear. But Paul's commentary here makes it clear that Ishmael turned to persecuting and mistreating this three-year-old boy. So the point that he's trying to make at the end of 29 should come clear to us. What is the point? Well, just like it was then, where the son of the flesh persecutes the son of the free, so it will be now. The children according to the flesh who are in slavery will persecute the children who were born of the promised Spirit. You see, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. Apart from this being the sign that we are not the children of God, the fact that we would suffer persecution is actually a sign that we are the children of the Spirit. And see, those who are in the spiritual seed line of those who do works of the flesh, and those who look to their efforts to get right with God and to earn eternal life, they don't like to be told that their efforts aren't good enough. Those who go to church don't like to be told that they're going to hell if they're trusting in themselves. And you know, it's interesting as we look at our society and our world and our nation and how it becomes ever more secular and secular every day and week by week. And that pains us, and it should, and it should concern us for many reasons. And we've talked about that before. Yet, you know, history shows that it's not secular opposition to the church that is most severe and most common, but it's religious opposition. It's those who are involved in some sort of religion, who are working their way, doing good things. They don't like to look at those who are trusting in God's promises and for us to say, God makes a big deal about them, but all your works amount to nothing. And we know that the final manifestation of persecution to come, as we see in the scriptures, it's not going to be a secular movement of opposition. It's a religious movement that turns its fury on the saints and on the people of God. But here's what we have to do. We have to take hope. We have to trust what Paul is saying here, that his gospel is the outflow of all of this. It is the next progression of God's plan in the scheme of redemption. And we have to trust that just like God dealt with the persecuting, mocking Ishmael and made way for God's chosen to be the focal point of promise and inheritance, we too have to trust that one day it will be evident that we are the focal point of God's power, his grace, and the inheritance. For what does it say? Going back to Genesis 21, Paul quotes here in verse 30, "So she," Sarah, "said to Abraham, 'Cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of the slave woman will not be an heir with my son, Isaac.'" You see, we have to trust that the end of all this is they are the ones who will be cast out, not us. And that the gospel of works, the gospel of faith plus works, is not a true gospel. That is what descends from the seed line of Hagar and Ishmael. Whereas Paul's gospel of faith and promise is what comes from the chosen seed line. And see, we have to trust that if God was able to deal with competing rivals for gaining the blessing like he did with Ishmael, and still bring a child of promise against all odds, that they will be cast out and not us. You know, I was thinking this week of what Jesus said in John 6. He said, all that the Father gives to me shall come to me, but him that comes to me, I will in no way cast out. But yet you go to Matthew 22, and there's a party, a feast that is made, and invitations go out. And yet what is found among the guests is a person who did not come into that party in the right way, wearing the right garments. They weren't dressed in the righteousness of Christ. Rather, they were dressed in their own way, according to their own doing, in the way that they liked. And how does that parable end in Matthew 22, 12 through 14? The master or the king says, bind that person hand and foot and cast them in the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Those who are of the seed line of Hagar and Ishmael will be cast out. And it looks like perhaps they are winning now in the sense of they're right, that they have it all, that they are the ones who know what is best. And boy, it looks like they're having fun and that it is worth it. But we, like them, have to trust that one day we will not be cast out. And it will be evident who we are. It even is now, but then even more so. Do not depart, Paul says, from this gospel that I first preached to you. And you know, we're going to move on to the duties of the Christian life. We're going to move on from here. Next week, we're going to transition a bit, starting the transition to the duties of the Christian life. But I beg you, I urge you, like Paul did, don't move on until you've embraced this gospel. Maybe this is the illustration it took to shake you up and make you see who you are, what you're doing. You cannot trust in yourself in any way. No matter what your lineage, no matter what your relationship to those who are the people of God, it doesn't matter. You have to come to God on your own terms, by faith, trusting in the promise he has made in his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. Don't move on from this until you have dealt with this, and that you are now behind this, that you get this, and you're passionate about it too. But for the rest of us, hopefully we've been encouraged. And Dave and the worship team, if you come up, we're going to sing a song reminding us of what has been done to us. I know some of you have probably been like, Paul, I get it. Jared, Mike, I get it. But you know, we all learn in different ways, right? And I'm so thankful for Paul, the master teacher, who didn't settle for just one explanation or two or three. He came at this gospel from every single angle because it is rich, but ultimately out of his love for God's people. And hopefully you love his gospel that much more because of what you've seen the last several chapters. So Dave and team, go ahead and lead us in song, and I'll pray after.